The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
This is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
This week, a conversation about gun violence with Shannon Watts, founder of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America.
After the horrific shooting in Sandy Hook, I saw pundits and politicians saying that the solution was more guns. Our nation was broken, and I wanted to act.
Tune in this weekend for politics, policy, and a side of pop culture. The Takeout with me, Major Garrett.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
What's at stake for the U.S. as Turkey fights with Kurds in Syria?
There are ISIS detainees in the area Turkey has seized.
Plus, the White House defends the Trump resort where it plans to host the G7 summit.
It's not the only place. It's the best place.
And now, from the Capital One Bank Studios in the CBS News Washington Bureau, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Let's start this weekend with the fighting apparently continuing between Turks and Kurds, despite efforts towards a ceasefire arranged by Vice President Mike Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, meeting Thursday with Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
Well, it's been a shaky ceasefire and a shaky deal. Not everybody here is happy about it. And as for the role of the U.S. military, there are some serious questions about exactly how the terms of that ceasefire will be implemented. Turkish attacks continued on the border, breaking the so-called pause in hostilities. 120 hours, 5 days for the U.S. to facilitate the reason Turkey went to war in the first place, the removal of Kurdish forces from a 20-mile-deep safe zone along the Turkish border. But Pentagon officials tell CBS News so far they've received no direction as to how to remove those forces, and there's no change to America's own withdrawal plan. Still, at a rally in Dallas, President Trump painted himself as a kind of playground peacekeeper.
It was unconventional what I did. I said, they're going to have to fight a little while. Sometimes you have to let them fight a little while. It's like two kids in a lot. You got to let them fight and then you pull them apart.
But it's far from child's play for the hundreds of people killed and almost 200,000 displaced by the fighting. And Turkish forces have been accused by a chemical weapons expert of using what looks like white phosphorus against Kurdish civilians, banned by chemical weapons conventions. The U.S. has declared a ceasefire to a war they weren't even fighting and enabled Turkey to achieve its primary objective, which has enraged U.S. lawmakers on both sides of the aisle.
What we have done to the Kurds will stand as a blood stain in the annals of American history.
Now, it may be telling that Turkey is calling this more of a pause than a ceasefire. Why 5 days? Well, that's exactly when Turkish President Erdogan is due to meet with the real power broker of this region, President Vladimir Putin, in Russia. Charlie Daggett of CBS News in Tehuk, northern Iraq.
The U.S. also monitoring the ISIS prisoners in that safe zone. More from CBS's Cammy McCormick at the Pentagon.
Defense Secretary Mark Esper says he's talked to the Turkish defense minister and reiterated Turkey must adhere to the full terms of the agreement. And he reminded him there are ISIS detainees in the area Turkey has seized. U.S. ground troops, meanwhile, continue to leave northern Syria, so monitoring the situation will be more difficult. The U.S. is continuing surveillance flights over the region to monitor the agreement and the status of ISIS prisoners.
The president's acting chief of staff now playing defense following his comments Thursday about the president's call with Ukraine under investigation by House Democrats as part of their impeachment inquiry.
Things have just gone from very, very bad to much, much worse.
After rejecting the notion of a quid pro quo for weeks, the White House appeared to suddenly switch gears.
And I have news for everybody. Get over it. There's going to be political influence in foreign policy.
Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney said the president did withhold millions in military aid to extract a promise from the Ukrainians.
He's like, look, this is a corrupt place. I don't want to send them a bunch of money. Did he also mention to me in the past that the corruption related to the DNC server? Absolutely. No question about that. But that's it. And that's why we held up the money.
He's referring to a debunked theory that Ukraine secretly helped Hillary Clinton and that 2016 election meddling actually originated in Ukraine, not Russia.
All roads lead to Putin.
Mulvaney's comments directly undercut what has been the Republican defense of the president.
Every single witness, every single fact has not supported any aid pause or hold up in foreign aid. being attached to any conditions.
Mulvaney also suggested the president wanted Ukraine to cooperate with a U.S. investigation. But a senior Justice Department official pushed back in a statement, saying if the White House was withholding aid in regards to any investigation at the DOJ, that is news to us. By nightfall, Mulvaney was walking back his comments, saying in a statement there was absolutely no quid pro quo and that the president never told him to withhold any money over a server. But impeachment investigators were already focused on his earlier admission. New Jersey Democrat Tom Malinowski.
Mick Mulvaney basically confirmed to us the heart of the matter here, which is the Trump administration held up at the president's order vitally needed security assistance to Ukraine for political help from the Ukrainian government.
Mulvaney did insist the aid was not conditioned on an investigation into the president's potential campaign rival.
The money held up had absolutely nothing to do with Biden. There's no question. And that was the point I made to you.
CBS News chief congressional correspondent Nancy Cordes. Mulvaney discussed Ukraine with reporters after announcing President Trump's resort in Miami will host the G7 summit next year.
Just look at the terrible foreign corruption of the Bidens.
The White House announcement comes as the president has repeatedly accused his Democratic rival Joe Biden of self-dealing.
The Bidens got rich while America got robbed.
It's not the only place. It's the best place.
Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney said there is nothing improper about Doral hosting the summit of foreign leaders because Mr. Trump will not earn a profit.
I don't care about making money.
According to the Constitution, all federal employees are prohibited from accepting any gift or fee from a foreign government.
With Doral, we have a series of magnificent buildings. We have incredible conference rooms. The ballrooms are among the biggest in Florida.
Doral is prominent among Mr. Trump's U.S.-based properties. He reportedly took out a $125 million loan to buy it.
He's got a lot more invested in Doral than he does in, say, the Trump Hotel in New York or other places, because this is his money and he's on the hook for the loan.
Jonathan O'Connell of the Washington Post said Doral's financial situation is stressed, with net operating income falling 69% between 2015 and 2017. Next year's G7 summit will come to Doral when it needs revenue badly. June is part of the club's seasonal slump, when visitors tend to shun Florida's heat and humidity.
You're going to have not only the business that you're going to get, but you are going to have the greatest advertisement for a property you could ever have.
Chief Washington correspondent Major Garrett. Funeral preparations are underway for House Oversight Chairman, Maryland Democrat Elijah Cummings. He died early Thursday morning.
Cummings, who represented Baltimore and surrounding areas, hadn't been on Capitol Hill in over a month after being treated for an unspecified ailment. Cummings was an attorney who served as a Maryland state lawmaker until rising to Congress in 1996. He fiercely defended the rights of minorities, particularly when it came to fair representation.
Voting is crucial, and I don't give a damn how you look at it. There are efforts to stop people from voting. That's not right.
Congressman Elijah Cummings was 68. Bill Rakoff, CBS News, Capitol Hill.
Coming up, Brexit's wild ride as the clock ticks to October 31st. That's next on the Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
A new look at the Trump administration's VA from its former head.
A new book by former Veterans Affairs Secretary David Shulkin says President Trump considered issuing an executive order to close parts of the VA health system without consulting Congress early in his presidency. In the book obtained by the Associated Press, Shulkin describes an Oval Office meeting in which Mr. Trump pressed for ways to quickly shutter underperforming facilities. Objecting to the time it would take for a congressional review, Shulkin said the president said, let's just do an executive order. He told the Associated Press he dissuaded the president from going that route. Pam Coulter, CBS News.
Tuesday's CNN and New York Times presidential debate with 12 Democratic candidates featured what may be the biggest matchup in the race so far between Senator Elizabeth Warren and former Vice President Joe Biden.
It's kind of about time other people get questioned.
Joe Biden acknowledged that it's newly minted frontrunner Elizabeth Warren, not him, who took most of the heat. Instead of being the candidate taking the hits, now he's delivering them, specifically blasting this Warren comment on foreign policy.
I think that we ought to get out of the Middle East.
I hope she didn't mean in a literal sense, because if it would, it would be, I think, a disaster for American security.
Warren later clarified she meant combat troops. Biden's on the offensive because he now trails Warren in early primary states and some national polls. His fundraising also lags other contenders, and he continues facing questions about his son's business dealings in Ukraine.
She's going to have to tell the truth.
Biden and others questioned Warren's credibility for refusing to say how she'd pay for her Medicare for All plan.
Your signature, Senator, is to have a plan for everything, except this.
At least Bernie's being honest here and saying how he's going to pay for this.
But Warren insists the wealthy and big corporations will pay.
I will not sign a bill into law that does not lower costs for middle-class families.
Warren took her own shot at Biden, refusing to give him credit for helping to launch the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, an agency she helped create.
I went on the floor and got you votes. I got votes for that bill.
I am deeply grateful to President Obama, who fought so hard to make sure that agency was passed into law.
Aides to Biden say that we can expect to see the former vice president raise more aggressive questions about Warren's candor if, in their view, she fails to answer more questions about her proposals. But the Warren campaign says it'll keep doing what it's doing, building national support by emphasizing those policy proposals. And a sign of her growing grassroots support tonight, Warren and her campaign are calling 1,000 small dollar donors across the country to thank them for their support. Ed O'Keefe, CBS News, Davenport, Iowa.
The nationwide United Auto Workers strike against GM appears to be ending.
Sources familiar with the proposed contract say it includes pay raises, lump sum payments to workers, maintains low out-of-pocket costs for health care, and has a path for temporary workers to become full-time employees.
Hope it's beneficial to some of the issues like temporary workers and a wage parity and things like that.
Jesse Hall has worked at GM in Flint, Michigan for some 40 years.
Negotiations are coming to an end and we can get out of this cold.
UAW leaders are telling members to keep striking as they review the proposed deal. After that, the rank and file will have to approve it. This has been the longest national strike against GM since 1970, and by some estimates, workers have lost more than $800 million in total wages over the last 30 days. They're about to find out if it was worth it. Dean Reynolds, CBS News, Detroit.
British lawmakers are considering what may be their last chance deal with the EU on Brexit.
How are you feeling, gentlemen?
Prime Minister Boris Johnson defended his agreement struck with EU negotiators.
It means that we can deliver a real Brexit that achieves our objectives.
But the Brexit deal could be dead on arrival. UK opposition politicians were quick to shoot it down.
This is desperation from the Prime Minister. This is a national embarrassment.
We cannot support this deal.
Previous attempts to pass an agreement by former Prime Minister Theresa May failed. One of the main sticking points has been Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK. This new deal would give it a special status with the European Union to avoid border checks with the Republic of Ireland. A Brexit deadline is looming. Lawmakers must approve a deal by October 31st or request an extension. If Parliament can't find unity, the UK will crash out of the European Union without a plan in place to move forward. Ian Lee, CBS News, London.
NBA star LeBron James caused waves, weighing in on the protests in Hong Kong. More from correspondent Jonathan Vigliotti.
I believe he wasn't educated on the situation at hand.
He didn't want to start a feud, but Lakers star LeBron James did ignite a firestorm halfway around the globe. Protesters in Hong Kong burned and trampled his jersey, while here at home, critics piled on. And LeBron James memes are trending on Twitter. The backlash followed a pregame interview in Los Angeles. James criticized Houston Rockets GM Daryl Morey for a tweet supporting Hong Kong protesters, which read, "Fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong." It was posted last week before the Lakers played preseason games in China.
So many people could have been harmed, not only financially, but physically, emotionally, spiritually.
James tried to clarify his comments on Twitter, saying he was not discussing the substance of the tweet, only the timing, writing Morey could have waited a week to send it. The NBA and James's sponsor, Nike, have billions of dollars invested in China.
Jonathan Vigliotti, CBS News, Los Angeles.
Actor Cuba Gooding Jr. surrendered to authorities in Manhattan Tuesday. Here's CBS's Lisa Mateo.
Cuba Gooding Jr. smiled and chatted with his legal team after pleading not guilty to groping charges in a Manhattan courtroom.
We hope that this case will be a hallmark case for the Not Me movement.
The charges involved two incidents of sexual misconduct. The first came to light in June, allegedly caught on video. TMZ posted images from a surveillance camera that appears to show the Oscar-winning actor touching his accuser, although it's unclear from the video whether any groping occurred. Gooding's attorney says for 4 months, prosecutors have conducted interviews, reviewed videos, and even evaluated the DNA found on an accuser's dress. But he says they don't have enough evidence to convict.
We are shocked, outraged, and absolutely dumbfounded that the district attorney's office has wasted the taxpayers' money, resources, and time.
But the prosecutor says there were even more accusers. She wants to call up to a dozen additional women as witnesses in Gooding's trial who will allege sexual misconduct incidents over the past 18 years in hotels, bars, and restaurants. If found guilty, Gooding faces a maximum sentence of up to 1 year in prison. Lisa Mateo, CBS News, New York.
Up next, journalist Ronan Farrow on his new book about his reporting on powerful men accused of sexual misconduct.
It can transport people into the events in a way that a magazine article doesn't typically.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
For 48 Hours fans, a new podcast.
I'm Erin Moriarty, 48 Hours, and this is my life of crime.
Revisit the Lizzie Borden murders.
Lizzie Borden took an acid.
Go behind prison walls.
What was the crime that brought you here?
Hear a horror story that hits close to home.
Erin, there is no excuse to give your home address to a serial killer.
And much more. My Life of Crime. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Capital One Bank Studios in Washington, this is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Ronan Farrow is out with a new book. You've probably heard about it, Catch and Kill. In it, he reveals new details about the stories he's pursued, including Harvey Weinstein's sexual misconduct allegations and Matt Lauer's firing from NBC. He joins us from New York. Good to talk to you, Ronan.
Pleasure to be here.
Ronan, I'm curious, how hard was it for you while you were defending your reporting to save some of these explosive new details about the stories you've been covering for your book and not just report them out?
Well, you know, for any story any of us in our business pursues, you start to get a sense of the amount of space you're going to need for a complicated body of investigative reporting. And it became rapidly apparent in this case that the years of reporting that we're accumulating and ultimately made it into Catch and Kill would require that amount of space and that format. And, you know, the advantage of it being saved for a book, I didn't slow down. I was breaking story after story in The New Yorker, and then I just started pushing those stories into the book, was that it can transport people into the events in a way that a magazine article doesn't typically. You know, it is a narrative. It has twists. It's character driven. And I hope that that, you know, is not just a source of drama, but also a way to expand people's understanding of what it's like to live through these events, whether you're a source struggling to speak, a whistleblower coming forward, or a reporter facing crazy cloak and dagger tactics as you pursue a story.
We've seen already a lot of responses to this book, including from Matt Lauer's folks from NBC. Mm-hmm. Has this even triggered new leads on any of these stories?
It has. There's been, in most of my stories, an outpouring of sources coming forward in response saying, me too, and here's more information that corroborates it. And that's absolutely been the case with the reporting I did on CBS, the reporting I did on NBC. You know, these were stories that were not about any one individual, although there are serious allegations of misconduct against NBC executives in this book. It's about systems, and there are a lot of people at NBC and beyond, and at AMI and beyond, the publisher of the National Enquirer, which is another focus in this book, and in the world of private espionage and beyond, who are living through being shut down by these systems. being intimidated, being silenced. And so, yes, there has been a huge outpouring in response to this.
You mentioned reporting for NBC. You detail what you say was a coordinated effort at NBC to muzzle your reporting on Harvey Weinstein, and that triggered your resignation. So what would have to change there for you to ever consider working for them again?
Well, I explain in the book that I was asked to, and it was a complicated decision, and ultimately the accumulation of leads, of sources coming forward saying there is a serious pattern of misconduct, and in corporate and legal practices at the highest levels of that company, a serious pattern of covering things up. And we document a paper trail on that, that in a time when this company said there were no settlements or non-disclosure agreements with harassment victims, there were in fact seven. I then did realize, you know, I couldn't do that. I had to report on it. And, you know, I am frank in the book about saying nobody wants to lose their job. And when you lose your job, as I do in the course of Catch and Kill, and then have an opportunity to get it back, it's very tempting. But ultimately, the bravery of the sources I was working with who were coming forward with this difficult information and the bravery of people around me, you know, this is not like I'm making these claims. This is a lot of reporting and also other people involved making these claims. Then my producer at NBC just released a detailed article about his experience of being ordered to stop reporting on this. So it became apparent that, you know, I had to make that decision and that I had to spend a couple of years really getting the reporting airtight on this, which we did.
Do you want to see any accountability for your former bosses at NBC, including Andy Lack, for the way they handled your story and your producer's story?
You know, I am not an activist. I'm a reporter. And my job is to interrogate the facts as rigorously and fairly as possible. This book is extremely measured and fair about NBC News, about AMI, about Black Cube, this, you know, cloak and dagger secret private espionage firm that was hired to pursue me and others. It is fair in all those cases, and their responses are fairly represented. It's not my job to engage in this conversation that's playing out right now about who should get fired, who should not. I will say that I am heartened to see that the incredible journalists of NBC, and the book is in many ways a tribute to fellow journalists in general, people who pursued the Weinstein story and other tough stories over the years, but also specifically at NBC where I worked. It has been heartening to see that they are anguished about this and calling for a tough conversation about whether media companies should have secret settlements with survivors of harassment and abuse, whether leadership should be secretly engaging with the kind of chain of conversations with Harvey Weinstein that the NBC executives had, as documented in this book. These are questions that are now being asked by people within the institutions that the book reports on. And, you know, I won't comment on how that should go, but I will say that in both CBS's case and NBC's, I think a hard conversation was overdue.
I want to ask you just quickly also about these cloak and dagger techniques by which you say you were targeted. How were you a victim of that?
So, you know, I'm very conscious when I talk about this part of the plot to point out, you know, I was not a journalist in Pakistan or in Russia, you know, wondering if I was going to wind up dead the next day. I had the protection of the legal system in the United States. We had the protection of the First Amendment. And even when in cases where media companies become instruments of suppression, like AMI, like NBC in this case, there are basic safeguards for journalists. That's not true everywhere in the world. But I did think it was important to be frank about what I lived through, and not just me, a group of reporters lived through during this plot that unravels in Catch and Kill, because it shows how precious and fragile this institution of the free press is. And how, you know, as people react to this and say this is like a spy thriller, those tactics should be reserved for the world of spy thrillers and not directed at real world reporters. You know, I was surveilled and tracked and staked out and had to move out of my home, and sources were telling me to get a gun. And there were accusers, sources I was working with, who were literally infiltrated by undercover operatives who got to the point of being like their best friends. You know, this is wild stuff and shouldn't happen in real life.
Journalist Ronan Farrow on his new book, Catch and Kill. Thank you, Ronan.
Thanks very much.
Coming up on the Weekend Roundup, the surprise White House meeting with the parents of a British teen killed in a crash not going according to the president's plan.
They said they felt ambushed.
Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio, and I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
New U.S. tariffs targeting the EU took effect Friday.
I'm Gary Nunn. U.S. consumers soon will be paying more for such things as Scotch whiskey, French wine and cheese, even olives. $7.5 billion worth of goods produced in Europe. All are subject to 25% tariffs. Small U.S. retailers will be hit especially hard. The actions are intended to punish plane maker Airbus, which has had an unfair advantage over competitor Boeing. Also, aircraft produced in Europe will cost 10% more here, thanks to the tariffs. Gary Nunn, CBS News.
On CBS This Morning, the parents of a 19-year-old British man killed on his motorcycle in a crash involving the wife of a U.S. diplomat in the U.K. spoke out about their meeting with President Trump at the White House.
I offered to bring the person in question in, and they weren't ready for it.
Not only were the parents of Harry Dunn unwilling to meet the woman who killed their son in a car crash, they said they felt ambushed.
You know, to be thrown into a room together with no prior warning, that's not good for her mental health. It's certainly not good for ours.
Ann Sekulis, whose husband is a U.S. intelligence official, admits to driving the wrong way down an English country road when her car rammed head-on into Harry Dunn on his motorcycle, killing him. Sekulis later left the U.K. under diplomatic immunity. President Trump said what happened was a common mistake.
You go to Europe and the roads are opposite, and it's very tough.
Sekulis was invited to the White House, but in a separate room, when the president was with the family. Her attorney told CBS News she had gone there expecting to meet them.
We've said all along that, you know, we are willing to meet her. We are still willing to meet her. But it needs to be on UK soil. You
know, Harry's mother said President Trump told them that wasn't going to happen.
She needs to come back and face the justice system. She made a mistake.
All Harry Dunn's parents want is for Ann Sekulis to turn herself in. Impia Saib, CBS News, Washington.
Prince William and Kate have concluded their tour of Pakistan, the first royal visit to the country in more than a decade.
The royal couple chose a school in Islamabad as the first stop on their five-day tour of Pakistan, highlighting the importance of education for women. The Duke and Duchess met with students who revealed they were big fans of his late mother, Princess Diana. Princess Diana made three visits to Pakistan in the 1990s through her charity work.
There was a sort of magic which surrounded her. She was like a fairy tale princess.
She was a good friend of then pro cricketer and now Prime Minister Imran Khan. Decades later, Khan greeted Prince William and Kate at his official residence. British royals, including Queen Elizabeth, have made the trip to Pakistan, but it's been 13 years since the last visit, and locals hope the royal tour will boost Pakistan's global image.
People do not really visit Pakistan due to terrorism and all these things.
In recent weeks, the conflict between Pakistan and neighboring India over the region of Kashmir has escalated. Security concerns have prompted authorities to deploy more than 1,000 police officers to keep the royals safe. Cindy Palm, CBS News.
An American who teaches at Oxford may be in hot water for selling hot artifacts from the Bible. Here's CBS's Vicky Barker in London.
After a three-month investigation, officials from Oxford's Ancient Papyri Project have reportedly concluded that Professor Dirk Abink, one of the world's most celebrated classics professors, sold at least 11 papyrus fragments of some of the earliest Bibles known to the family behind the Hobby Lobby chain, who then donated at least some of them to the Bible Museum they founded. They're not commenting. The museum says it's returning the suspect fragments to Oxford. Vicky Barker, CBS News, London.
Remember when California shook?
Allowing Jose Canseco to score, and he fails to get Dave Parker.
It is probably the most watched earthquake in history. This is where I was 30 years ago, about to cover Game 3 of the World Series, when Candlestick Park began to shake.
I don't know if we're on the air. We are in commercial.
television, I guess. Well, folks, that's the greatest open in the history of television, bar none. We're still here.
Damage was widespread. More than 60 people were killed. More than 3,700 others injured.
Go home and secure your residence. Shut off the gas. Shut off electricity. Store water. Prepare for aftershocks. Prepare for 3 days of no service.
There was nearly $6 billion in damage. Even part of the Bay Bridge collapsed.
The bridge has collapsed.
This, however, is where the most violent shaking took place, more than 50 miles away. I'm in Santa Cruz, California, near the epicenter. You remember it well.
Oh, sure. Yeah. The earthquake of October 17th, 89, 5:04 in the afternoon.
That's pretty precise.
Yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
Where were you? Right here?
I was right here. Yeah. I was right here. My father and I were right here. And things started to happen. And very seldom was my mom ever in the store, but she happened to be in the store that day. So I remember distinctly that she had just walked in the front door when the earthquake started happening. And I was in terror that the windows would shatter. So I was hollering at her. But luckily, none of the windows broke. Nothing shattered. We just had a huge amount of inventory on the floor.
Mike Mekas runs Andy's Auto Supply in Santa Cruz.
When it's over and you walk out in the street and you look up Pacific Avenue and you see just this gigantic dust cloud and people, hundreds of people out in the street trying to figure out what just happened, you know, and not knowing, you know, who was injured, who wasn't, and what had happened to all the other buildings. And then as the days unravel after that, then you start hearing the stories and seeing the stories and reading the paper about the deaths and about the heroes that pulled people out.
This woman is not sure if she remembers.
I was 1 and a half. Yeah. But our house fell down the mountain. I lived up close to Summit, and, like, it actually fell all the way down the mountain. I have, like, I think a fabricated memory of it, but I don't think I have any actual memories of it.
But this man does, and there's pain. He recalls the frantic efforts to save a 22-year-old woman who was trapped.
The haunting memory of digging out the young female who perished, that sadness is still with me 30 years later. I watched it.
It was the worst quake to hit the Bay Area since the infamous 1906 San Francisco quake. But seismologists say the area is still long overdue for a quake that's stronger and deadlier. Steve Futterman, CBS News, Santa Cruz, California.
An unpleasant October surprise for one Iowa family.
Bloody hell for a family in Bagley, Iowa, after the discovery of 5 inches of blood in their basement. The blood, along with fat and other animal tissue, somehow oozed into Nick Lestina's home northwest of Des Moines, presumably from a nearby facility that processes waste from local meat processing plants. Officials say a clog or break in the pipe diverted the mess, which came up through a floor drain in Lestina's basement. The company, now responsible for the cleanup, Lestina says it's really caused a stink in the neighborhood. Jim Shenavy, CBS News.
Coming up, the new look for astronauts.
NASA held a fashion show of sorts to unveil its newest spacesuit.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
She has brought us the world.
It is a new day here in this country.
And told America's most important stories.
How does a government shutdown affect national security?
She's opened our eyes.
And what happened to you?
I was sexually assaulted my freshman year.
And our hearts.
Were you scared?
Mm-hmm.
What were you thinking?
About my mom.
Now, she brings us truth and understanding right when we need it most.
Wow, this is pretty spectacular.
The CBS Evening News with Nora O'Donnell, weeknights.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Grainy video of a hotel under construction in New Orleans is being examined by investigators as they try to figure out why it collapsed, killing 3 people. And correspondent Omar Villafranco reports weekend weather is also posing a threat to what's still standing.
Oh, my God.
2 days before the accident, a concerned worker filmed an upper floor of the 18-story hotel under construction. He points to a series of red flags, like this floor-to-ceiling temporary beam supporting concrete slabs. In Spanish, he says, they couldn't remove this one because it's too bent. It has too much pressure. This is serious.
This was a cascading set of failures.
Civil engineer Norma Jean Matei watched the video.
It makes me wonder why. Was the brace damaged? Was the concrete placed not of adequate strength? Was the concrete just not strong enough?
Governor John Bel Edwards said the possibility of tropical storm winds moving in is posing a danger for the two damaged cranes still standing.
We are working as hard as we can on a timeline that will allow for those crane towers to actually be taken down safely.
Omar Villafranca, CBS News, New Orleans.
New findings about inclined infant sleepers after parents reported their babies died in them. CBS News correspondent Anna Werner has more.
She was everything to me.
Amanda Butler's daughter Aria died in a Fisher-Price Rock and Play inclined sleeper.
It's turned our life upside down.
Nationwide, 59 babies have died in incline sleepers since 2005, according to the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Millions of sleepers were recalled. Now, a study from the Consumer Product Safety Commission says that none of the incline sleep products it examined are safe for babies to sleep.
Babies are dying and have died in these products.
University of Arkansas's Aaron Mannin led the study.
Based on the results of our research, it's something that has to do with the design of a product.
Pediatric experts say babies should sleep flat on their backs, but some infant sleepers are set on an incline as high as 30 degrees. Doctors say the angled position can cause the head to fall forward and block an infant's airway. The CPSC says suffocation risk to infants disappeared when the incline was below 10 degrees. But doctors had warned of risks for years, and Amanda Butler says earlier action would have saved her daughter's life.
Our daughter had a full life ahead of her. She only had to live 10 weeks of it. I don't want anyone else to have to go through that.
The CPSC is expected to vote on the new tougher standard next week. It will then be open for comments. Anna Werner, CBS News, New York.
This weekend on 48 Hours, correspondent Jim Axelrod investigates the disappearance of Heather Bogle. Jim joins us from New York. Jim, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks for having us, Steve.
So tell us about Heather Bogle, how she went missing.
28-year-old single mother in Sandusky County, Ohio, works at a Whirlpool factory. Doesn't show up after her shift one morning. She worked the overnight, so she had left the Whirlpool plant at 6:17 a.m. and is never seen again. This is a fascinating story because Heather was so sadly and brutally murdered, and the story of finding her murderer is a real portrait in great police work. But there's another story here that the great police work actually was addressing some hideously bad police work that was the first attempt to investigate Heather's death. It was not just bad, it was criminally bad.
And that original police work involved three suspects who turned out to be innocent, right?
It involved a detective by the name of Sean O'Connell who had laser focus on three suspects who he pursued even to the exclusion of DNA, possible DNA evidence, and even in some cases a tip from other people who worked with both the person who was eventually arrested and pled guilty to Heather's murder and with Heather herself. So this detective, Sean O'Connell, sort of had a focus on these three suspects that is either, and his decision not to widen that search, even in the face of other evidence, is either ambition or it's incompetence, or maybe it's racism. We'll look at all three.
And eventually, police take a new look at his work, and it leads them to Daniel Myers. What kind of role did Myers have in Heather's life?
Daniel Myers was the kind of guy who, investigators tell us, sort of preyed on vulnerable women he could dominate, women he could control. Heather Bogle was fighting with some difficulties in her life. She was struggling. She had just had a long relationship come to an end. She had had some back and forth in the form of some painful texts from her brother that was giving her a hard time. She hadn't been able to pass her nursing exams that she so desperately wanted to pass because she wanted to leave the Whirlpool factory and find something even better for her child. And so working alongside her was this guy, Daniel Myers, who sort of positioned himself as a source of sympathy. Tell me all about it. Come talk to me. And so she went to his trailer and Investigators would later say that her decision to go to the trailer was what led to her brutal murder.
Correspondent Jim Axelrod in New York. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
You can catch 48 Hours on the CBS Television Network or stream it anytime on CBS All Access. Now to an emotional Michael Jordan making a big difference in the largest city in the Carolinas. CBS News correspondent Jim Crisola reports.
Tears streamed down his cheeks as basketball great and North Carolina native Michael Jordan spoke at the unveiling of the first of two medical centers he and his family funded in Charlotte.
As you can see, it's a very emotional thing for me. I'll be able to give back to the community that's supported me over the years.
Jordan's $7 million pledge will help provide medical care to low-income people, as well as those without health insurance. The six-time NBA champion owns the Charlotte Hornets. Jim Crisula, CBS News, Greensboro, North Carolina.
Finally this weekend, we can all dream, right? Here's CBS News correspondent Deborah Rodriguez.
The name's Bond. James Bond.
The Neiman Marcus Christmas catalog is just out, and the top luxury item is an inky blue Aston Martin DBS Superleggera designed by the latest Bond, Daniel Craig. Price tag, enough to make you lose control, $700,000. For $575,000, you can take a private jet to the Casbah, Italy's Dolomites, and the Ice Hotel in Sweden. $250,000 gets you front row seats to four of New York City's Fashion Week shows and a meet and greet with the designers. Deborah Rodriguez, CBS News.
That does it for the Weekend Roundup. Thanks for listening. The show's always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. We want to get your feedback. Drop us a line at weekendroundup@cbsnews.com. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. John Whitley is the technical supervisor. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.